work with living systems framework thinking. So there are model thinking where somebody puts up a model, we all knew the model, we run around it, and we're all asleep because we've done it so often. Framework thinking is alive thinking, and it draws on living systems to help us see how we think, how systems work, and how reciprocity happens. And as I said, these are really different than mental models, which give us the answers, the steps, the actions. It's repeatedly used. Nope, frameworks wake us up in the moment.
Welcome back to Business Second Opinion Podcast. We're always excited to bring you another episode. But first, we want to thank our sponsor, Business Second Opinion, Guayaki. I have not been disappointed in picking new flavors of Guayaki so far this week. Have you guys all tried Orange Exuberance? It's just awesome. And we're also glad that Guayaki continues to brew their mate-based goodness through this challenging time. Mate, it also turns out, contains 24 vitamins and minerals, 15 amino acids, and abundant polyphenols. So it gives me the energy I want, also being a healthy choice. We hope you're going to check out this beverage with your friends and family, and please let us know what you think. Business Second Opinion Podcast digs deep to explore questions about business and business practice. And in the process of examining them, we give you a second opinion. Usually a contrarian opinion, but one that's well-tested and proven to give you the outcomes you want without the nasty side effects. And by the way, if you want to learn more about how to work more closely with us, stay tuned to the end of the show. I'm Zach Swartout, and with me as always is Carol Sanford, our in-house positive contrarian, responding to big and hard questions with a radically different take. Hey, Carol.
Hi, Zach.
So we are going back to basics this time with a topic that I think we all know pretty well, but do we? Decision making. I can really relate to this one because I've seen how in other organizations, decision-making skills kind of get distilled down to matrices and consensus-building processes that get taught. But, you know, as it turns out, they rarely ever get remembered to actually get used. And more importantly, do any of these tools actually help? Well, today we're going to dig into an article that offers not a model, but 7 strategies for better group decision-making. And actually, that's what the article is called. And as always, it's from HBR, the September 2020 issue, so it just came out. And it's by Torben Emmerling and Duncan Reuters.
Ah, that reminds me, the decision-making thing. Let me tell people again of a new practice we put in place, thanks to Susan Gladwin, one of our super smart listeners. You can now go to the show notes in advance and maybe only a day before, but you can find out the reference article that Zach and I are using as a source for giving a second opinion. And there's even a link to follow. So, Zach, why do I call Susan smart for recommending this?
In our regenerative communities, one of the principles we work from is about specifically about learning is the idea of having a subject in mind before you hear or go to work on another's idea. So throughout my years in this work, it's been invaluable to be able to find a continual process of, I guess you'd call intentional thinking, that I can keep coming back to fresh over and over and over again with a different approach. And so the hard part, though, is actually being in dialogue with someone who I don't agree with, who may not share the same worldview as me.
Aha. That's risky, isn't it? Because you get ready to debate them. How do you get that value and not foment a battle?
Yeah, I mean, it turns out I come from a long line of debaters, so this is definitely my default mode. But I think starting from a place of caring for the other person, while working hard not to get myself hooked in the conversation, and set up a reflective conversation for both of us, more than a competitive space where we're just trying to convince one another of what we already believe, I think those are a good start. But as you hear my voice, it's obviously not always easy. And if you look at the current debate online, it's clearly not easy. So it turns out I actually just had a conversation with one of our contractors last week. And there was certainly a decision to make, but instead of me making it for him, I did my best to follow the ideas I just laid out. And it wasn't an easy conversation, but by the end, we were both grateful for it. And oh, surprise, surprise, turns out we made some decisions.
Aha. Well, you did give us a good start on today's second opinion on decision making. You know, I think maybe it's always helpful when you give us an overview and kind of outline form of the article, in this case, these seven strategies that we're going to speak about a bit.
Yeah, sure. So the issue, well, let me talk about a little bit first about kind of the premise of the article, and then I'll kind of go into their seven strategies. So essentially the issue, at least from my perspective, that they're trying to avoid by offering these seven strategies is this idea of groupthink, right? Or the idea that people's opinions can quickly become co-opted and then everyone ends up agreeing with one another because they just want to be nice to one another. This ends up degrading thinking, leading to less optimal and often more kind of narrow-minded decisions. So the seven strategies authors offer these, you know, strategies that are intended to arrest groupthink, among other things. But so let me lay them out here for you. So first of all, keep the group small when you need to make important decisions. That's number one. Number two, choose a heterogeneous group over a homogeneous one. At least they put in parentheses most of the time. Appoint a strategic dissenter or even two. That's number three. Number four, collect opinions independently beforehand, before this decision-making process starts. Number five, provide a safe space for people to speak up. Number six, don't over-rely on experts. And number seven, share collective responsibility.
Wow. Well, those are really fun to take apart. How about if we do a bit of our paradigm questioning here? Because one of the things we're really encouraging people to do is not read something and figure out whether you agree or disagree to start, or whether you even start taking notes and look at acquiring it. What we want people to do is really question what paradigm generated those seven strategies. How can you tell when you look at these?
Well, I think if I had to guess, I mean, I think they start from two places. First of all, there's a real desire to arrest the problems that come from decision-making processes and mostly groupthink, as they say. And as we've talked about before, this paradigm from which this kind of idea arises is called arrest disorder. So it has roots in most entropic views of the world, meaning that everything is seen as constantly tending toward chaos, and we as humans need to control those processes, or else, I guess, is what's implied there. So the other thing to note here is that they source their ideas from behavioral and decision science. So I wish we as readers had more details on those sources, because in just a cursory examination of behavioral and decision science, it entails at least 15 different disciplines of sociological research. And so we might say that some of these come from the human potential movement, like creating safe spaces, which this is the do-good paradigm at work, which we know. But one thing is clear, though, these land on me as less interwoven, kind of connected strategies, but more of a list of rules or steps I might follow when making a decision with two or more people.
And of course, that is primarily to keep things from going awry, as you right. said, the arrest disorder. And it's interesting how most things that show up, I'd say 70% of what shows up in Harvard Business Review is arrest disorder, because there's so many problems in running an organization. So here are what these seven are. I also notice there's a different idea about how people come to know something to be right and good. Like, you know, we got to know whether it's the right thing to do and it's going to be good for people. What did you see? I mean, it does relate to paradigm, but it focuses on how truth can emerge. You know, in science, that's called, or in philosophy, that's called epistemology of thinking and knowing.
Yeah, good point. So, for example, the authors speak in here about bias, which we've talked about extensively on the podcast before. The authors indicate that bias is something that needs to be managed externally through changing the size of the group or making sure that people get their thoughts out before the meeting on a shared document to be iterated on. The only issue, I think, and I think you'll agree here, Carol, is that they totally miss the idea of development. The implication here is that bias is always present, and so it needs to be managed for people because it's beyond their control, rather than seeing a decision as the vehicle for working to manage one's own biases through development. It's subtle, but here we see the traditional cue ball theory of humans at work once again.
Yeah, I think another thing that this article represented for me was this idea of that it's all about directly going after it. And you mentioned the cue ball theory is we got to hit this head on rather than backing up and thinking about the capability, as you said, the development. So I think it would be fun for us to offer a different set of strategies from a different paradigm and a different epistemological view, and maybe even a framework to help hold in mind what might be called regenerative decision-making process. Zach, what would you like to, would you like to apply them as we explore today? You know, any recurring upcoming big decisions with your life or your business partner or super alloy, your company and their clients, anything coming up?
Yeah, this is great. Okay. So, but first for the audience, before we get started, I would encourage you to hold in mind a big decision that you have coming up as well. And watch that subject in your mind as Carol asks questions. Okay, so big decision. We potentially have a big hire coming up, and my business partner and I need to come to some kind of a decision about making this hire or not.
Whoa, that's a big deal. All right. Well, I'm holding in mind seven strategies, but from a different level of how we learn, from how the world works and how humans work. And in the show notes, we'll put this into a framework so that you can see how it all fits together. I'm going to just do them one after another. All right. First strategy, intend to and design for the development of people, ideas, and decisions simultaneously. You don't do it separate where you go out and train people. You do it in the midst. So that would mean all events that are going on to, would be used also to develop people. And by that, I mean like their critical thinking skills, systemic thinking, their personal self-management. An example, in DuPont of Canada, Peroxide, they had a monthly strategic meeting to make and evaluate decisions. They always invited visiting members to the core team, which was a group that managed the interface between the inside of the business and the outside. And they also rotated some of those members every year. They had a resource, you know, people like you and me who ask crazy questions, who would work with the task leader and the visiting members to plan the meeting in advance, not to interview people. They designed the meeting using a living systems framework, which we keep harping on, and what are we thinking, right? And both the task leader and the visiting members got better at framework thinking, breaking up those mental models and bringing in something that gave them ability to invent and create. They never used agendas, but an overall flow that was building something. So, Zach, do you have a process for doing this or an experience? You know, what do you see of the is the value of that for a strategy?
So we're still pretty young, but I'll say that it's become clear that as we get busier, we need ways to keep everyone on the same page, right? And not only that, but growing and learning and having us all build towards something that's not just about motion capture shoots, right? That's like the base level of kind of what we're doing. I see this as immensely valuable because it means we're all growing together rather than keeping information siloed with just my business partner and I. So I think in terms of hiring, this is critical to bringing new folks on where we're bringing them into a structure where they can immediately contribute and create their own trajectory in relationship to our team, customers, and larger work.
That's great because you're doing the work while you're going to look at a way, how do you develop people so they can contribute, they can learn? All right, second strategy, use the core team members. In your case, you're a real small group right now. You're also the actors who carry things out. But you will eventually, in most organizations, once you got 10 people, you need some core team that reflects the whole. You need them to be able to make decisions quickly. If expertise and information is needed, a core team member stewards that area in advance. So in the Peroxide group, when we needed information about a specific customer or a technology that we're using, we had people who were stewarding that over time. They would test with their own experience with customers, suppliers, contractors, and their own lived experience. So it has to become internalized by at least a few members of the group about how and what you're going to work on. So the reason for this is you don't want an expert's advice always that you don't understand what you're going after. So what we did in the peroxide group is we always made sure that somebody worked with the expert outside so they understood, not just know and accepted what the expert said. Key here was questioning the outsider's idea for its paradigm. So this is part of the development. So we got an expert, they're saying so-and-so to us. If what they're doing is giving advice on how to change people, we know they're likely very behavioral. If they're giving us information on how it is we have to think about it, now we're talking, right? We can give something more, but we also can tell what the source of that advisor's thinking is. So the epistemology in the second one is a non-expert driven epistemology, how people know, how they understand, how they evaluate, how they internalize an outsider's thinking. So the process, if you think about what I just described, is avoids a hierarchy being evident, whether it's an authority by rank or authority by expert, because this strategy is about leveling the playing field. So I don't know, what do you think, Zach? Does that resonate with you? And how does that make possible, what does it make possible to not be dependent on an expert or authority view? And how does that compare to something like managing with group size and, you know, experts cautioning you?
Totally. I mean, I think, first of all, it starts to kind of take away the idea that there is a single expert and that person is elevated from everyone else, right? So in a sense, like, expertise becomes distributed and it becomes, And it flattens that idea of what an expert is and supposed to be. You know, and I also like this because it's not removed from the work process. So often, right, like, development happens on a retreat or at a conference room, offsite somewhere. But this is about the work we're doing right now. And its subject is our clients and their lives. And all of a sudden, the decisions are contextualized for the whole team, allowing them to build their decision-making capacity, not only for that moment, but ongoing for their work and their entire life.
Yeah, I think this is so core. If you aren't growing people inside of the organization or always dependent on experts, consultants, or contractors or something, then your people aren't growing. So let's take it to the third strategy. The third strategy is to engage in reflection and to do this at every transition point. Now, what I mean by reflection is inner and outer reflection, where you're looking at how are you growing? How are we working? What's going on? How's the decision-making process working? What's moving? What's changing? Because we want people as part of development to get unstuck and unattached to past positions. Now, what do I mean at transition points? So I don't, in my groups, let anybody take a break until we do reflection. You have to, or if we're going to change subject, nope, you have to do reflection. We also do it at the beginning and the end of a day. So anytime you're going to move from one subject or perspective, you stop and do reflection. Now, that may sound like, why would you do it that often? Because you're growing people at the same time, plus you will improve with all the machinations this article had, the quality of decision that's being made. So in DuPont and in most places I work, there's a process that we use, a framework and questions that go with that, or we develop them. We don't, a model would have a given set of questions, but we will develop one. Like you've heard us on here talk about the law of three, the activating, restraining, and reconciling. We may frame questions. It was used in the time and space we were there to enhance the capability building that you started us with. and to ensure ableness for self-reflection. People don't do that. I once in a while, we have a new person come in, will say, do reflection. They'll say, well, I have nothing to say. And I said, you're not noticing anything about yourself? Nope. It can be an unfamiliar thing. You have to learn that if you want an organization which is really good at the quality of decisions and of the group being able to work and evolve and move decision-making forward. So there's this inner and outer reflection. Now, let me offer a caveat here. Reflections are reflections on ourselves, either me personally or us as a group looking at the group as a whole. You don't ever comment on another person. This is not a matter of feedback. It's really about commenting on the mental energy of the group. How's it working? You always use we or I, never them or they. So what does that add for you, Zach?
For sure, I can see how ongoing personal reflection is critical, right? But let me take a little bit of a different tact here. So decisions are events. Right? They're moments in time that are reflective of a larger process. And so often we treat decisions as the beginning and the end instead of this kind of ongoing reflective process that allows decisions to occur in a larger stream of work.
Yeah.
So hiring this person becomes less about a hiring decision, I think, and more about the ongoing evolution and growth of our company as it seeks to contribute.
I love that because I do think that's exactly what you're doing. You're in a stream and the reflection is having you do those snapshots, kind of like your company, right? Mm-hmm. To capture something.
Totally. So
fourth strategy, ready for this one. I don't want people to think about necessarily having a sequence like an agenda, which I miss, but you really do want to begin to connect with the right flow and the right timing. Where are we? How do we all know? If I'm saying, don't have an agenda, well, what have you got? I want to point to this specific strategy, which is work with living systems framework thinking. So there are model thinking where somebody puts up a model, we all know the model, we run around it, and we're all asleep because we've done it so often. Framework thinking is alive thinking, and it draws on living systems to help us see how we think, how systems work, and how reciprocity happens. And as I said, these are really different than mental models, which give us the answers, the steps, the actions. It's repeatedly used. Nope, frameworks wake us up in the moment. They're designed to be disruptive, but also to have people be able to see relationships between things in a system and all be able to work on asking questions and know where we are in the conversation. So we work so that we've got developmental thinking where we have a framework, not a set of answers, but things we can develop. And by the way, there are no best practices because every event, every decision, every beneficiary we're trying to understand and serve is different. So these frameworks, these living systems frameworks, give a shared language, but they also help us know where we are in the conversation without being a linear.
And Carol, for our listeners, let me speak to what is a framework for a second, our newer listeners anyways. So a framework, like if I were to use a metaphor to describe a framework, it's kind of like glasses that you would put on or maybe even a set of windows on a house. So they offer different perspectives on the same whole, in other words. So frameworks are used to help us pull ideas apart to see how they work individually but simultaneously together. So if we look at frameworks versus steps to take, for example, frameworks are about building a capacity to see different worlds on an idea. The value of this is that it allows new thinking to enter for all involved. So you contrast that with like a set of rules or a list. And so I know for me, I design lists to get through things as quickly as possible to get back to what I actually want to do. And rules are often things to be avoided.
Yeah, so I agree with everything you said except pulling ideas apart. I think that your windows metaphor is perfect because if you're looking at something, you want to keep looking at the whole, but you want to put like a laser on something in context. So now those first four strategies are all missing something. And you already said, yeah, it was missing development. They have kind of what I call artificial constructs that make them up. So like the number of people attending, procedures, like going around and pre-collecting ideas from people. My goodness, now they come in with the ideas they already had. The whole meeting ought to be moving it. So frameworks missing are creating, the fact that frameworks are missing produces a profound gap alongside poor quality to think. There are a few core values and uses that frameworks have, right?
Yeah. So first of all, they disrupt, as you said before, mental models, which make us really kind of examine borrowed ideas that each of us had never thought to question. And secondly, they have us all on the same point of the framework at the same time versus having dissenters with fragmented ideas, which they offer as one of the suggestions. And really, that's just artificial anyways.
Oh, that drove me crazy. Having somebody who artificially agrees to dissent. If you know about frameworks, you know about the law of three, and everybody looks at all the restraints at the same time, and they will have new thoughts. They're not bringing their old stuff. So we are building a new set of thinking in a decision-making process, not just sharing points of view. And a framework makes that possible. It drives connections to the holes which they're embedded in. It's based on reality, not on some kind of social constructs we make up to manage things that we think will go wrong or be missing. We're also looking internally at our own thinking and having a framework on board on the wall with the scribe at the framework. And we're looking at what's on the board, not at one another. Zach, give me an example with one of your partners. I bet you've used a framework. And what did it do for you in decision making?
Well, it's funny. I have a story of I just did this the other day with my wife, actually, and she and I have a bit of a competitive streak in us, as you are well aware, and that's not always helpful, and that shows up at inopportune times, like, you know, when we're trying to make decisions that she and I need to make as a family. And so using a framework allowed us to actually approach the topic from a more neutral place, where we're thinking together more than as two people with different agendas. And so we ended up having this conversation with a new understanding of one another, which also created a path forward. Surprise,
yeah, surprise. I'm delighted to hear that. Mm-hmm. And the fifth strategy is work from connecting to greater wholes. So one thing is true of all the strategies that we're offering today, as well as all the frameworks, is they always have a system context. They aren't about two people, you and me, talking to each other or us in one piece of work. No, we're thinking ultimately about the beneficiaries of our work and who will, like our customers, our clients, community, who is going to be affected. So we use improvement in their capacity, in their lives, to set a direction based on what they're counting on us for. And we use that as a guidepost, not what it does for us only. We get something back, but we get it from being of service. You know, we're a product and service organization, right? I mean, that's what creates safety. And this whole day of psychological safety is driving me crazy, because the safety comes from everybody working on what the beneficiary external to the organization needs, not protecting each other so we can argue ideas or offer ideas. If we're all talking about how does that idea work for the customer, we might all get in the customer's shoes for a moment. Now we don't have to worry about anybody feeling unsafe. We're all working for the customer. It's all reconciled by our work for them. So that's part of the pre-planning process of the leader of the event, the resource, and the scribe role, which we'll come back to in just a moment.
So when I think about the hiring process that my business partner and I need to embark on, it's like we now have a reconciler for how we come to this decision. Right? Our customers, at the end of the day, they're the ones who ultimately benefit from this hire. So it behooves us to think about their perspective and benefit rather than being locked into our own.
Yeah, absolutely. Getting any hiring or any boundary process connecting to the external world will make such a huge difference. And by the way, I just mentioned that we come back to these roles I keep hinting at, task leader, scribe. The sixth strategy is to set up roles that cover a longer set of meetings, maybe divided by the subject or windows of time. We are rotating because, again, we're building capability. There are three roles which are critical. One is a task leader who guides the agreement on the process you're going to use, pays attention to the quality of thinking and the progress being made toward those decisions, and watches how they're unfolding. The scribe is stewarding the use of frameworks and keeping those up on a board, a flip chart, a chalkboard, a whiteboard, because if you have everybody working with the framework in front of you, you can co-generate ideas that become available for all to see. So if you have everybody taking their own notes, you really disperse and fragment a group. The scribe only write something when agreement is reached. Even if it's overturned later, that's fine. But you know where you are in the framework on that part of the agreement you just made. The third role is the resource. Now, what that person is doing, and we've talked before about resource means resource, helping people go back to themselves and self-management. The resource. So you got the task leader getting the work done, watching the quality of it, the scribe helping the quality of thinking be developed. The resource is watching the level of mental energy. They're bringing up questions that help people reflect. They invite deeper thinking. They may put in restraining ideas, or they may restrain ideas that people have that are old and repeating themselves. I mean, they could say, let's stop and reflect for a moment. Do we feel like we're bringing new thinking into this, or do you still all have the same thinking when you came in the room? And everybody gets stopped for a moment. They, I came in with that idea. The resource's job is to disrupt that process. But they're using a framework when they ask that question, so people or principals a group has.
Yeah, and the resource also is ensuring the capability development at the personal and group level is foregrounded to using the process to grow both the team and the organization. They're often more connected to frameworks, and so they can be using the framework to help bring structure to the conversation. And this is used in tandem with the need to get decisions made. So they're not the judge of the group, but the servant of conscious thinking.
Absolutely. And they aren't giving people the answers, as you say. They're not the judge. They're giving questions they can see will help. And everybody agrees on that's their role. So you don't have somebody who is a contrarian offering outside opinions. No, you have someone who gets a group to reflect on how well they're doing that together. All right, our final seventh strategy. Here we're talking about a group becoming sensitive to the quality of decision that they're making based on understanding how tied it is to the mental energy, the modes of behavior, the level of paradigm that's being used. So if you keep this overtly present and reflect on it, how do we feel about the quality of decision? How is our mental energy going? How is that affecting it? What would we say about whether we're being reactive to certain things? How can we manage that? And a group is working together. No one is after someone else. You keep this idea in the foreground. And I agree, it'll seem a little annoying first, but you build the capability to make great decisions fast. And over time, you're able to do all of this very quickly, and you need less stopping except to do quick reflection. So the reflection process, I said earlier, I just want to re-mention, is always using a shared framework. And the framework being up on the wall has us looking at the wall, less at each other. We're all working on something together. Zach, how does this apply to your example and experience you offered earlier?
Totally. So I can definitely attest to that. And I think most people can too. When I make a rush decision that comes out of fear and trying to control a situation, what I come up with generally doesn't last, takes not enough into account, and is more about me than a larger and more meaningful subject. So with this hire, for example, back to the thing I'm trying to work on here, I definitely see how my business partner and I need to be deliberate about how we approach this from a regenerative frame.
Yeah, great. So I think it'd be helpful. I'm just going to get us started on reviewing those seven, where first one was we really wanted to work on developing people, ideas, decisions simultaneously, not one and then the other.
Yep. And second, use the core team members to make the decision.
Yep. And then engage in reflection at transition points.
Right. And then you work with a living systems framework for thinking.
Yep. Then you keep everything connected to the greater whole that's external, the beneficiaries who ultimately will live at the mercy of our decision.
And then you set up roles that cover a longer set of meetings, maybe divided by the subject or windows of time or rotating who leads ultimately.
And finally, we really come to understand that the quality of the decision we make is reflected not to this artificial structure they was talking about, but the quality of mental energy and our ability to reflect on that, our behavior, our paradigms, and make all decisions from there.
So we have openings for many of our communities to do this kind of thinking starting in January. For-profit, not-for-profits, and hybrid board of directors or advisories. Educators in all domains, women entrepreneurs, or business teams working on a regenerative approach to strategy, leadership, and management. Email us if you're interested at carol@carolsanford.com.
And in addition to that, we always need your help. We need you to recommend an article or a business practice on which we give a second opinion. You can still get a second opinion mug if you take that on, and you can email, same email, carol@carolsanford.com or at Business Second Opinion. You also can find us on Twitter, biz_second_opinion. And we greatly appreciate it when you can donate something to support our production costs, and you can find that on Business Second Opinion's webpage.
By the way, your organization can join a book club. For The Regenerative Life, which Carol just published. So using an extensive workbook and video online workshops for free. So you can find out more at carolsanford.com.
Great. And sign up for our newsletter so you keep in touch with the show notes, when we're publishing new things, and what's happening next.
And thanks as always to Numi T and Babson College for sponsoring the Regenerative Business Summit and Prize annually, as well as the Business Second Opinion website. Find out more on our website at businesssecondopinion.com. This has been Business Second Opinion.